Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Let's have a nice cup of TRE in the afternoon with Hannah Murray.
Thank you. Dexy's Midnight Runners and Come On Eileen. Joining us on the line now is Nige Tassel, who for the past 20 years has written about music, popular culture and sport. For his 10th book, Searching for Dexy's Midnight Runners, Nige employs his skill of detection to go off in search of the dozens of members who are a part of the group. Welcome to the show, Nige.
Hello, lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. So how many members are we talking? I know they sort of changed over the years, didn't they?
It's a very fluid lineup, shall we say. and certainly up till about 1985, 86, which is when they are known as Dexy's Midnight Runners. They reformed later just as Dexy's. And in the later years, there's a lot of session musicians. So it's a case of whether you count those or not. But there are roughly, you know, I tracked down sort of two dozen. There are a couple who remained elusive, a couple who didn't want to talk. And so we're talking at least 30 in the sort of the glory years between sort of 1978 and 85.
Oh, amazing. And what made you decide to look for them? Are they famously aloof?
My previous music book found me on a similar mission where I went. There's an old NME tape called C86. They used to do mail order cassettes, and in 1986 they put together a compilation of 22 indie bands. This is before the term indie had come along, really. Sort of scratchy sort of garage bands, and some of them had become famous from that. Primal Scream, The Wedding Present, people like that, The Soup Dragons. Others had just fallen by the wayside. So I put my detective Deerstalker on then and tracked down members of all of these 22 bands, some of which had, you know, largely removed themselves from the face of the earth. And I enjoyed the whole part of detection so much that when it came to, right, what's the next book? I wanted to get that Deerstalker back on. If I'd ever been a policeman, I could have only have worked in CID, I think. I love that piecing it together, you know, little bits of evidence and untracking people and uncovering them. So that's what I did. The Deerstalker went back on and off I went in search of them.
Oh, brilliant. I mean, it must be quite difficult. It depends if people want to be found or if people don't want to be found. You know, if you're all over social media, it can be pretty easy to track people down. But if there are people that don't want to be found and like to keep themselves to themselves, I imagine that's quite difficult.
Yeah, I mean, if I was doing this 20 years ago, it would be a slightly more romantic affair. You know, these days I could just type in Joe Bloggs and, oh, there he is, and I've sent a message within 2 or 3 minutes, you know. It's reassuring. It's really nice when you can't find them, when you haven't got a lead. And so with one of them, the bass player who was given the stage name Giorgio Kilkenny, he was the bass player on Come On Eileen. He never worked in music again, and his real name is Mick Gallick. Didn't want to be found, clearly, because I messaged all the Mick Gallicks I could find. But I ended up putting an advert in the Birmingham Evening Mail, just trying to get him. So those old fashioned techniques are quite good as well. That's kind of romantic. It's not a lot romantic, just kind of searching for people on LinkedIn. You know,
no.
It can be too easy. You know, I wanted to be a bit of a challenge and a bit of an odyssey, a bit of a journey. You know,
yeah. So did it work, putting that notice up?
Absolutely not. No, I wasted a full £7 putting in a little classified ad. Pretty cheap, though. I was quite impressed. It's only £7 to put one in for a week. So,
yeah,
but no, he remained underground, yeah.
Oh. So, I mean, when you got hold of some of them, did they not put you in touch with other members, or were they very like, no, no, he doesn't want to be contacted?
Yes, there's a few saying, oh, I'm still in touch with X, Y, and Z, and... I always try to do as me finding that person as much as possible. But yeah, a lot of them kind of stayed in touch. Others were reluctant to talk, but most were. And the thing with Dex is, you know, they had such a recognisable leader in Kevin Rowland. You know, the second album, in fact, is billed Kevin Rowland and Dex's Midnight Runners. So the album Two Rye A, which Come On Eileen came off. So he's very, very, very much the leader. It was very much his band. So I found this as a way to hear the stories of those who wouldn't have been interviewed back then, who wouldn't have, you know, the third trombonist or the, you know, the third drummer they'd recruited. These people who wouldn't got a word in edgeways in the interviews back then. And it's refreshing to hear their side of the story as well and piece together. There's a lot of shared history between all of them, you know, and they've got three very different incarnations. around the time of Gino, their first number one. They're all wearing woolly hats and carrying holders. They look like burglars on a mission, you know, and they were jumping the barriers at train stations, you know, playing up the hoodlum card. Comes to Come On Eileen period, it's all dungarees and espadrilles and long hair and, and then you get to the third stage, which is the least successful one with 1985 with the album Don't Stand Me Down, where they'd gone for, you know, proper, beautifully tailored suits, a real change of image from, you know, the hairy armpits phase of the Come On Eileen years. And so you got three. So it wasn't, whereas previously with the other book, I was after 22 bands. Here, it was a different task. I was still being the detective, but it's all about one band. So there are three different incarnations in there. So there's plenty of stories. Everyone's stories overlap. Everyone's stories contradict each other. And I find that's really interesting. And then having spoken to five of people, say, about a certain incident or a record, you know, you kind of start getting the truth. You sift through everyone's stories and kind of find the real narrative and what actually went on there.
Yeah, fascinating. So the ones that didn't want to be contacted or didn't want to talk, do you know why? Was it because of any particular controversy or something that went down that they didn't want to talk about, or they just wanted to be private?
I have to say it's very, very few who didn't want to talk or who I couldn't, you know, who remained elusive. I think, you know, it was quite a tumultuous band. I've just said about the three eras. I think all those three eras, there was a lot of tumult in that band, and lots of arguments, and the fact that, you know, 40 odd people were members suggests there's a lot of, you know, the exit door and the entrance door were constantly swinging. So whether anyone particular, you know, some people just don't want to go back there, you know, and if they were sacked from the band and that was their chance of stardom and they never made it, and then they turn on Top of the Pops and they see the band they got sacked from 6 months earlier, yeah, suddenly having a number one hit, that's kind of painful. Yeah. So I don't push people too much. You know, I don't want to, you know, any psychological scars to kind of, you know, open up again fresh. So, I, you know, if they want to talk, great. If not, you know, I'll try and tell their particular story in absentia if we can.
Yeah. And in terms of what they were trying to achieve, did you find that out? I mean, they were very different at the time, the early 80s, where there was a lot of neon and craziness and crazy hair and things going on at that time. And as you say, the dungarees and the denim and the hairy armpits, they were yeah, quite special, you know, weren't they?
They were special, and that is Kevin Rowland's genius, I think, is that the way he ran that band, very disciplined, you know, you had to, there would be no girlfriend. You had to give up, originally with the band when they started in 78, you had to give up a job. You had to sign on to the Dole. You had to give up girlfriends. You had to go to the rehearsal rooms, which would normally be somewhere they'd broken into, some squat or something. And you rehearse like a job from 9 to 1. Then they'd go to the cafe for an hour and then 2 till 5. And then they'd go out in the evening as a bunch, still, as the, you know, in their kind of uniform, their attire, because they were, you know, they had to absolutely live it, which is very different from, you know, bands who are just after stardom who get a manager and they'll kind of happily do whatever it is they want. And so in their own way and with their own sound, you know, a sound that was very at odds with, you know, the synthesized early 80s, the Human League and Yazoo and all of that in the first half of the decade and all that day glow clothing. They forged their own path, and they forged their own path twice to the number one slot. So they must have been doing something right and realised that to be different, you could then stand out, and therefore you had more chance of making a deeper impression than lots of identikit bands who were quite similar.
Yeah. And how about the amount of people in the group? Why do you think there were so many of them? I don't mean that took part in the band at any one time, but I mean at the same time with all the different musicians, and why is it that they needed so many people, do you think?
Well, I mean, you know, it was a large band at any point. You know, it was 8 in the first instance, and then they brought in the violins and fiddles. Mm. So when they toured in 82 on the back of Come On Eileen, you know, it's an 11-piece band that's going on stage. You know, and some were just session musicians who would be brought in who weren't kind of full-time members, whatever full-time member meant. There was a lot of discrimination. There's the usual stuff, the usual politics that goes on with the band, you know. when they signed to EMI for their first album and for Gino, it only comes out months and months later that three of the eight are actually signed to the label and will be getting any money other than, you know, a kind of meager weekly wage. So we'll be getting royalties. So we get to the point, they've had a number one single, but within, I think it's about 4 months, that band has imploded because five of them have said, we're off, thank you, we're forming another band.
Yeah.
And so there are lots of episodes like that where, you know, people don't feel they maybe got the deal or the fair crack of the whip that they wanted, or they maybe, yes, I want to be a musician, but I want to play more of a role in forging my own musical identity, you know, because a lot of them were, as I say, almost session musicians. Come in, you could play it like this. There wasn't a lot. It's so disciplined, you know. There wasn't a lot of room to express your own musical personality. So a few people went that way as well and then formed other bands and became successful. But others then kind of go, well, I've done it. It was great fun while it lasted. I'll just go off and do a regular job now. I need a regular income. I've got a young family, etc. And being a, you know, a hairy man in a pair of dungarees, you know, how long is that going to last? Is that really a job for life?
Yeah. I've always wondered how that works, actually. I guess it's always different for every band or for every artist. You know, when you've got some artists are solo artists, but yet they have the same drummer and guitarist and bassist that play with them everywhere they go, but they're known as a solo artist. And then others that are a group and they quite clearly have four members who all play a different instrument and do something different, and others that, you know, it's all very different. And I always wonder how that works with the money.
Yeah, well, yes. I mean, books, many, many books have been written on the money and the politics behind the music industry, you know. And it may be that, you know, that person with the backing band writes all the songs and everything. And I mean, these musicians know what they're getting into and saying, right, you are my backing band. You will be getting X amount a week or whatever.
Yeah.
They know the deal, you know, and if it means they regularly work and it means they're on tour having, you know, a great time and lots of adventures in their 20s or whatever, then absolutely fine. You know, who's going to, you know, you could be down the factory instead where your schoolmates were. Why not, you know, be flying around the world? And if it means you're not a fully paid up member of that band, you're still doing something quite glamorous, and you know, you'll have lots and lots of tales to tell for the rest of your life.
Yeah, it's true. It depends what you want, doesn't it? You know, if whether you're quite happy being Ed Sheeran's drummer that not many people might know the name of, or whether you want to be in a band where everyone knows your name and you're a proper member.
Exactly. And when everyone knows your name, so if everyone's got a vote, you know, that's far more likely to result in a band breaking up when there's arguments because everyone's got the vote. Whereas if you know, right, whatever Ed Sheeran or anyone else like that says goes, well, that's fine. Those are the rules of engagement.
Yeah.
And if you're happy to abide by those while staying in 5-star hotels around the world and playing to 30,000 people. And I think most of us can kind of bite the bullet and bite our tongues then, couldn't you, really?
Yeah.
When you suddenly see your monthly wage packet going, oh, okay, that was quite good. Oh, yes, and it was all paid for as well. Fantastic.
Definitely. And also, as we've seen more and more over the years, being famous isn't always the most fun thing to do. You know, years ago, youngsters were saying they really wanted to be famous, but I think we've seen a lot in recent years, particularly in the entertainment industry. It's not all fun and glamour, and the idea of not being able to go to the supermarket without being accosted doesn't sound much fun.
Well, exactly, you know, and to bring it back to Dexys, you know, I spoke to these people who weren't interviewed back then and wouldn't got a word in edgeways, but in fact, they're probably quite happy about that. You know, they wouldn't be recognised going when they're out of their dungarees and just going to the supermarket, whereas everyone would have, you know, Kevin Rowland was one of the most famous pop stars of the early 80s, you know, utterly recognisable, whichever outfit he had on, whichever style or he was at that particular time. So if you're the, you know, very few people would recognise the tenor sax player in Dexys at any given time, or the drummer or so-and-so, if they're out of that kind of uniform, whatever that uniform was at the time. So best of both worlds, really. Yeah.
And how about the songwriting? And was it Kevin who was in charge of all of that?
I mean, Kevin. Yeah, you know, Kevin was mainly the lyricist, definitely. And he would always have like a first lieutenant in the band, there was another Kevin who would write the tunes for the early stuff. There was another Kevin, too many Kevins, so he has to be called Billy. And Billy and Helen O'Hara, the lead violinist, you know, they were a real unit sort of off the back of Two Rye and going into that third album. So he wasn't great. You know, he wasn't a musician, Kevin Rowan. He played the guitar a bit, but he wasn't. He would always have someone helping him with the music, and he'd be the words man, definitely. And also the mission statements. They'd have manifestos, you know, and the behaviour. He would still be in charge of the whole look, the whole ethos of the band, you know. So on that tour around the Come On Eileen time, they'd be playing big places, you know, good 2,000 capacity guild halls at that point, you know, that would be filled to the rafters. But you don't smile on stage. None of that. We've had a number one single, but we don't smile. We don't look at the audience. And, you know, the bass player was telling me, no, what you have to do, you focus on the fire exit sign at the back of the hall. And that's what you do, because you're aloof from this. You're not part of this. This is really different to other pop groups that would be more interactive. It's very much a performance that people are watching. There's no interaction. You know, no one's getting on stage, being invited on stage to dance with the band or anything like that. Mm. There's very little banter between songs. It's all about, we are doing a performance. It's almost theatrical, because they were so rehearsed, you know, doing that 9-to-5 rehearsal every day, that they would be so tight. And that's what it was. It was like everyone had to know their lines. It was much more theatre. And they would play theatres rather than the regular sort of beer kellers and, you know, the more regular rock venues. They would play seated theatres a lot of the time as well. It was, yeah very much a theatrical production quite often.
And did fans at the time like that? Did they appreciate that they were doing something different, or did they want to interact with them a bit more, do you think?
They probably would. You know, when they had Come On In, their audience changed. You know, they used to go, they went on tour, famously went on a tour with the Specials back in the day, and those were really violent gigs. Real lots, you know, right, sort of 79-80. So the country itself was a bit of a powder keg at that time, but the audience there, so there would be a lot of kind of old soul fans and people who get into ska from the Specials and the Selector and stuff like that. By the time Come On Eileen comes around, they're on the front page of Smash Hits, you know, and they're not necessarily smiling for the camera, but they'll be doing interviews for them. They're kind of, you know, they were more accepting of the pop world. Yeah. And so their audience is much younger. It is, you know, people, you know, a lot of kids in their early teens, you know, 13, 14, 15-year-olds, who probably are the ones thinking, oh, this is different. This isn't Duran Duran. This isn't Depeche Mode. This is something different. Maybe a bit, what's a banjo? Look, they've got real instruments. They're not standing mutely behind synthesizers. So they were very much different and probably offered something different. And then maybe the people who then got into Dexys got into more sort of alternative music from that as well.
Yeah. And Kevin was a bit of a heartthrob at the time as well.
Well, you know, he's a charismatic man. and... You know, he was just such a figurehead, such a leader for that band. And you can say, oh, well, he, you know, and people, he has been talked of it. Oh, you were a dictator in that band. But that was the genius of it. That's how they stood out, you know. It wasn't like, oh, we're all going to sit around and everyone's going to have this interview and we're all going to have an equal say and an equal share. It wasn't, you know. He was the one who shaped that band, the look, the sound, exactly what he wanted, the mission that they were on. And so from that, you know, he is the centerpiece, you know, and you know, various looks over the years. So we had the hairy look at that sort of time, Come On Eileen time, then into the very smart suits within a couple of years. You know, he looks very different. You know, parted hair. They were criticized for looking like bank managers, which they didn't care about, but. There's so few bands that other bands would slowly evolve, and Dexys just kind of, he would just draw a line under something, go, this is the direction we're going in now, complete left turn. And that gave the band longevity. And here we are 40 years later, still talking about them.
Yeah. And when they went their separate ways and some of them went off and started other bands, was it similar kind of music?
Some of them did. Yeah. Those first five who who disappeared straight away, who when they found out they weren't actually signed to the record company and therefore wouldn't be seeing any royalties of the number one single. Yeah, they went and formed a band themselves. And one of their lot was Mick Talbot, who then started the Style Council with Paul Weller. Oh. And then later on, we have Helen O'Hara, the lead violinist. So she still plays now. She tours with Tanita Tikaram. She plays a lot with Tim Burgess from the Charlatans, performs a lot with him. Others went on to form orchestras even. So the other violinist, Roger, he runs the Emerald Ensemble in Bristol. They all had fascinating lives, and they all look back on it not necessarily fondly, but it really shaped them, you know, and they are grateful. Almost everyone was grateful to Kevin for the opportunity that he gave them, because some of them could barely play an instrument right back in the early days. They just liked the look of them, maybe. I thought, oh, you look like a drummer, or you look like a bass player. You could learn that instrument. And so the opportunity that they gave them, and then they've stayed in music for the rest of their lives. You know, the original drummer, he lives in LA now as a producer, worked with Sting and Lauryn Hill and everyone. He wouldn't have done that if Kevin hadn't just said, yeah, you look quite good. You look quite good in a woolly hat and a donkey jacket. You'll do. You'll do. And so even if they've gone on back to Civvy Street and done regular jobs, they've got this amazing time that they were in Dexys doing crazy things.
Yeah.
But then a lot of them, off the back of that, and, you know, and their CV looks good. If you've got a number one single on your CV, you know, people are going to stand up and take notice if you want to stay within music.
Yeah. And with all the people you spoke to, were there any gems that you can share with us? Anything that you were surprised to hear that you thought, oh, this is great for the book?
Oh, that's a bit of a question.
Sorry.
Nothing springs to mind immediately. But everyone was really nice. I'll tell you what, the one thing, I was, so when Gino came out, I'd have been 11 years old, and they looked like the hardest men ever. You know, they would, if you saw them coming down the street, you know, in their donkey jackets, each of them had a holdall, as if it, you know, as I say, like looking like burglars off to do a job. You know, you'd think there'd be a crowbar or two inside there. Really double hard. And they just, to a person, were just the sweetest, loveliest people, you know. So you've got Jeff, who was the tenor sax player originally. I went to his house in Cornwall, and his wife came out, and she baked me a cardamom and orange cake just for my visit. And that was
lovely.
Really sweet. So, you know, I was expecting to be maybe a bit more abrasive, but everyone's, you know, it's just at that time, you know, they're in their early 60s now, most of them. You know, there's a point at which you kind of make peace with the past.
Yeah.
And you can look back and with some fondness, at least, you know, some things might still get their goat. But, you know, the fact is they weren't really double hard so-and-sos that I, you know, as me as a weakling, little wimpy 11-year-old would have thought so. But yeah, I'd say able to hold my own, but they were all lovely people. So yes.
Yeah.
Yes, that's probably the thing that's kind of, I expected a bit more spikiness, I think. But everyone was like, yeah, really, really sweet, willing to talk, and all really articulate. And with the passing of years, they've all been able to kind of come to terms, but also kind of put it in context a bit.
Yeah.
When they're in the eye of the storm, it's hard for them to kind of take in exactly what's happening around them.
Absolutely.
And it's only when they're kind of out of there and there's some distance that they kind of go, oh, God, yeah, that was a thing, wasn't it?
Oh, amazing. Well, if people want to get a copy of Searching for Dexys Midnight Runners, it's available on our website, tre.radio, and it's by Nige Tassel, who we've been chatting with today. Nige, thanks so much for joining us.
Lovely, lovely to speak to you. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye.
See ya.
stage is that well swinging high.
Oh, Gino.
This man was my farmer's, my dex, he's my high.
Dexy's Midnight Runners and Gino, their first number one.